Okay, there we go. So, good afternoon. So today we're going to start talking about databases, the last component of a web app that we haven't really talked about. So to really start off with this, I've already shown you a database example. Remember this? Did you understand it? This was the blog. So today we're going to start going through it because you have most of the tools for understanding what this code does now. And the only piece you have missing is the database, and I'll walk you through how that actually works here. What it means when you're running this MongoDB thing, and you'll see some stats about it, and then we'll... So I'm going to start very practical, and then if we get through that, then I can talk more high level about what this thing actually is. So, quick questions or... This is part of what we're going to go through. So first off, I haven't actually set up this machine yet with these things, so we're going to run them right now, and I'm hoping they will run quickly. Okay. And we go here. I don't have wireless. I'm on the wired network here. So, see this thing? Okay, what? Well, oh. Okay, that's good. Okay, oh, now I have to do the other. Oh, I guess I just did one line at a time. That's really weird. Okay, this. Enter. So first, let's go through these lines here real quick. So this first one installs a certain number of packages that I already had. This next one adds a repository that's not part of the standard Ubuntu repositories. Now I'm updating things so I get the latest packages. Now I make sure I have all the things we actually want.
Why does it
yes.
Include downloading Node precompiled and Node as C code?
The dev one?
Yeah.
The dev one is for building the interfaces. So the idea is that when you have the, you need the dev package if you install anything, like through NPM, that wants to build binary things that link against Node. So.
It's just like having not done that, everything seems to work so far, but what you're
saying. Well, with Express, to get the, well, yes, yeah, exactly. Well, particularly with MongoDB, I think it has some C stuff. So now this is running. This is okay, let's see what the time estimates say. Okay, good. Not too long. So that's now downloading. We'll let that go through, and then we have, then we'll run npm install express, and then we should be set for doing this. Now, I already have the blog example here. We can start looking at that while that runs. What did this say here? Okay, close. I already ran it. Okay, let's cancel. Okay, let me make this a little bigger. How can you see that now better? Class web fund blog. So here, so this is the same blog example that we had before, except I made a few tweaks to the files. In particular, if you go to, I made it to be more in conformance with the Express examples we had seen before. It had taken a few shortcuts, so I updated a little bit. I'll put this new version of the code up. Go. And let's move that over here. Okay, so Express app. Things here look basically the same. Express, routes, HTTP, path. There's this thing, article provider, which is our own file that we'll go through. And then we go through this. We do our configuration. This is all basically the same. There's an error handler thing. This is all the same. Then we add, we have a few things here which are in the main file. Should these really be here? These app get things?
No.
All these routes should probably be factored into the routes directory as a separate module.
They're so small.
But they're so small, so
yeah, you know,
it's here. But so what we now know is that we know about gets and posts. So we have a get for getting slash and slash blog slash new. Remember, slash blog slash new is for creating a new article. Slash is for the list of entries. There's a post for blog new. So there's a form that's done in the new page that we'll see that when you do a post for it, creates a new article by calling articleprovider.save, and it gives it two things. One is the article. The title is the title that came from the form, and the body is the body that came from the form. Right? And you send that and create a new blog post. Now, what's this function here?
Callback.
It's callback. Right. So, but what do you think it's for? So what this is this is a function that's called after article provider is done. Why is that?
Congratulations, you've posted your blog.
No, but in terms of flow of control, normally when you call a function, you want it to return to where you called it from. Here, we're calling this and we're not telling it to return to us. Why shouldn't the function just return? What's the flow of control of this? Yes?
So you don't have to wait for it to finish.
Well, when does, you know, what does app post do? This is the server.
Yep.
When we call this app post here, we are defining a post method. You know, basically it says when a post comes in for this URL, blog new, do this. Has a post happened yet when we're running this code first time? No. This is happening in initialization. No post has happened. We're giving instructions for something to happen at a later time, which in principle might never happen. So we're saying when this thing happens, then call article provider save based on the response request. Now, after you've saved the article, this function for saving the article is a generic function for saving things. Where should flow of control go after that? It would finish the function, but this is a generic function, this saving function. It just does something generic. Like, what should be the follow-up after the article is saved? What this is saying, after you've done what you're going to do, run this function. And that function does a redirect to slash. Which means that after you have done a successful post, after you've created an article, it will go back to the main page, which gives you the list of articles. That's the response that you'll get from a successful post. Is you won't get this could be a page saying, your article just was posted. And it could have been that, but instead this goes back to the front page. But the main thing to know is that this is specifying execution that will happen later. And we define a function here, because it could have been a named function, but we're just defining it on the fly, because this function will be called by article provider save when it's done saving the article. And in fact, not just error, it has this. It takes two things, this error docs. So that means that if there was an error, this might actually be different. We'll have to look at the code for article provider save to see what it does. Following? So, yes?
So, get is you basically tell Express if you get a get request, get request to this URL, run whatever.
Yeah. Yes.
So post is basically the exact same thing except for on a form submit?
Yeah. Because forms are submitted using POST.
Right. And in terms of the way a POST request is structured, it also has a URL associated with
exactly
where they came from?
Exactly. When you say a GET or a POST, you specify a URL. And then you have the form body, which is passed as attributes
so
as the request.
Is there
what's
any reason at all other than simply HTML makes it convenient to do a form and a submit button, typically posts, to pick one over the other?
So in principle, you can do, well, not in principle, in practice, you can use GETs for everything.
Right. They just show up in your thing.
But the reason why you don't want to do GETs for everything is normally GETs are used for things that don't change the state of the server, and POSTs are used for changing the state. So it's just a thing coming back to the server. It's in some ways, it's just A and B. The semantics are slightly different in how the information is passed back, but
except for when you're doing the unique URL.
That's in the URL, that's not in the GET or POST. So there are RESTful APIs, so web application APIs that use GETs for state transformation on the server. They do exist. It's annoying. But so now there's this blog add comment. Now, as you recall, we didn't finish the functionality of this. This is actually what you're going to do in tutorial. This next tutorial is finish the comments for this. So, and then we have our create server. So let's go back. Do we actually have this now done? Yes. Good. And we go over here, we do our, over here.
The save method itself wasn't persistent.
Sorry, what?
The save method, it wasn't persistent.
This is what we're going to be talking about here. So, so that's installed. So now, first off, this MondoDB thing. I want to show you what it turns out there were two versions of this. There was also this was the memory version. Alright, did that again. I'll remember what my key sequence is. Okay, fine. Buffer. Okay, so you see how often I do that. So this is the same thing, except it doesn't have, instead of article provider, it says article provider memory instead of article provider MondoDB. That's the big change. Otherwise, the code is basically the same. If you look through it here. So if you look at article provider, so we're going to go through article provider memory first. So all this does so this is the module for, this is the thing for providing this. So it says article provider is a function. It now creates a bunch of things. Now notice how it uses this prototype thing? That's because it's using the new on the other end. They decided to do that, so we get this here. Anyway, so it says, okay, here we go. For find all, it says find by ID. So find all says just return the dummy data, which is initially defined up here. So simple no data transformation. Here you go. Here's the array. Then we go over here. Find by ID. What does it do? It loops through the array, tries to see if the one has the appropriate ID, and if it does, then it returns it. Linear search, slow. But for our purposes, who cares? It's a dummy thing. And then it calls the callback. So you notice all of these have a callback. And what's the last thing they do is they call the callback. And they call the callback with null, saying there was no error. and then the result. And the result is this. So again, save, what does it do? As you might expect, it just adds it to the array. Now, there's a little bit of funniness with this right here. What's that if statement for?
If articles isn't already an array, make articles an array that contains articles.
Exactly. Exactly what it is, because this means that you can give it an array full of articles, each of which is an object, or you can just pass it an object that happens to be an article, and it will use that. Do that in Java. You know, I mean, you can do it, but I mean, it's a lot more complicated. You have to start having multiple prototypes. And,
You can do it with one variable.
Yeah. Yeah, so, but the idea is that this articles, it checks to see if it's an object or an array by checking whether it has a length method. If it doesn't have a length method, it's not an array-like thing. So, it must be, you know, we'll make it an array, we're just...
If it's an object that you define that also has a length property, then you're screwed.
Yes. But if you give it a length, like, because if there is a length one, then it can do this. Can iterate through them.
Can you just check to see what the constructor of articles is? So if the constructor is array capital A.
No, because it might be an array like object. It's something that has only a gap or an array, but it's not actually an array.
It does have a constructor of length, right?
No, not necessarily. You can have things that have length that are not arrays.
Okay, sure. Maybe you went to get array or
sure. Yeah, but in any case, the reason why it's checking for length is because can I iterate through it? If I can iterate through it, then it can sequentially go through it, and it go counts the articles, and it says it sets the article ID, you know, article.id equals article counter plus plus. So basically, it incremental each article gets the next sequence, and then it gives it a new date, saying the articles create this. See, it's saying the particular article to this, and then adds the comments. So there's no comments. It adds the empty ones, but makes all the comments created, you know, at today's date. And then adds it. Now this, I haven't checked this, but this line seems a little funny to me.
It adds it to the end.
Huh?
It adds it to the end. Right, it's just a push.
Yeah, exactly. I think this code only works if you call it with an object, or with an array of length one. Otherwise, I think it drops all the rest. Is that right?
Oh, yeah. What?
Well, what does it do? So this, why is it saying dummy data, the length?
What's the
length?
Back
it onto the end.
Length is like size.
Right. Oh, I guess it's putting it as the last element
of the
dummy data.
It really just all push, so I don't know.
Right. Oh, okay, yeah, you're right. That is just a push. Yeah. Okay. So then, and then you call the callback.
Can you just very briefly callback?
What's this callback?
Yeah.
So we just saw it. Remember the save? It takes an articles and a callback.
Right.
We were over here.
Really,
so articles. What? Huh?
We should really check if callback is defined before we go ahead.
No. So when we call, article provider save. Takes two arguments, an articles and a callback. When we call it, see here we're calling save, we call it with the article, which is defined right here, and then we and then the callback is this.
But it's,
right?
This is in this specific situation, but it seems like the
they don't get
notion
the callback
of,
for an exception.
Yeah.
Yeah,
you're supposed to give it a callback function. If you don't give it, you're...
What I'm wondering about is that pattern repeated throughout?
Yes.
And?
Yes. That's the way this, that's in, so think of it this way. If you're this is the way the this article provider API they've designed works like this, and the reason they've designed it like this is because then they can have generic database type operations that just do back-end storage, and then what you do after you do the storage is can depend upon context. You have these very general functions for doing the saving, and then how your flow of control continues is controlled by the callback. Because instead, what you could do is just here, call save, and then do the other thing. You could just put it in the body here.
Right.
But
would that make it synchronous as opposed to asynchronous? Or?
It wouldn't make it, I mean, in the body here, it's synchronous. This thing is, one thing is happening, then the other thing is happening, and the other thing is happening. So you could just have had this call, instead of having the callback here, you could have called it here. Except that, where is the error? The error that is happening from the save operation, you know, it would have to be, it could be the result. But the style here is, no, you call the callback, give it the error, and then give it whatever the result should be. This is a very classic thing in JavaScript. And that's one reason why I haven't been talking about JavaScript passing around functions, because, see?
Is that covered in the good part?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, this is... like callback functions are a key part of asynchronous programming. Because it's all about saying, I'm going to set up an operation, but when I do something, I don't know when this event's going to happen. So I'm just going to give you a function to call when the event happens. Now that's particularly true for like the get and post, and it makes sense because you're waiting for an input coming in from a remote site. But here, you could design the database API in a different way, but this is just how they've done it. And you'll see with the MongoDB stuff, you'll see when we switch to it. But with the dummy one, it looks kind of stupid. With the MongoDB one, it looks a little more interesting.
What determines whether a function call is blocking or not?
Function calls are always blocking.
But, so there's this event loop.
Right, no, I'm saying a function runs termination, but it's a question of what the function does. All this post is doing is registering a callback. That's all that function does. I mean, all that call does. It says, here's a function. Call this function when the criteria at the beginning is met, which is when you get a post at this URL. So this returns immediately. It just defined a function. I mean, it just defined a callback. That's what the whole, all of this is. This code here finishes like that. It does configuration, it sets all those callbacks, and then it goes in the listen. This is the event loop. So this is now app listen. We have been using that form. So here's the one we've been using. So once you do this, it creates the server, you know, object. It calls listen on it, the port. And so now, when this function starts, it keeps running until the web server is terminated. That's your event loop. Execution goes boom, 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 runs this, and then you're in this loop. You're not doing anything else after that. When that returns, you're done.
I guess what I was wondering about is in Node.js, or I think Node.js Beginner or whatever, he has a section where he discusses synchronous versus asynchronous calls, and this notion of how do you get around your database call blocking everything else? And like, how does the magic occur where you sort of fire it off but continue?
Which is exactly why you do these things with these callbacks. Because you're basically doing this database request. You don't know when that database request is going to finish. That's what I was going to get to. You know, next, but we don't know when that's going to finish, and so you give it a callback so that whenever the database operation finishes, do this callback. And note, you could say, well, why don't I just wait? You could be handling other requests.
Never wait.
Never wait. Remember, this node is not multi-threaded. That is very important to realize. It makes it much easier to reason, I think, about node programs, but it also makes it a little weird because you're handling events and there's no other thread to do things. So you have to make sure that you are not doing lots of work in any function. Really, a node program shouldn't be doing lots of computation by itself. If it ever does lots of computation, it starts up another process or tells and asks another process to do stuff. And then when it's done, it reports back. The database is doing heavyweight operations. You tell it to do stuff, and then when it's done, it will contact you. Otherwise, you're handling requests.
So you can do parallel, but not with threads.
What? You can do parallel. Well, yes. And in fact, yeah, very much parallel, but it's not multi-threaded. So that means that this particular process is doing one thing at a time. And if you want something else to be happening in the background, you give it to another process, which has its own memory space, doesn't see your variables and everything. It's separate. You communicate with it by messages.
So, in effect, the in-memory version is kind of redundant in that.
Yes.
It's still within that process.
So right. Exactly. That's why this doesn't make much sense for the dummy provider. Let's first get this. Now that everything's running here, let's get this running. If I did everything right, I do node app mondo.js. Express server listening on port 3005. Yay. Localhost on 3005. So, blog. So, we have no articles. Right? So, let's create an article. First post. Did it. So, we have a post. Now, this is using the MondoDB version. So, we'll go through that there. But first, I want to show you a little bit of magic. Host. Okay, so if we go to the code here, you'll notice up here, and where is the DB? New article provider on localhost port 27017. This is the call in the MondoDB version. We're talking to, so give it a host and a port name. So we go over here, and I connect to that port. I'm curious, what's listening on that port? So it says, for HP diagnostic access, add 1,000 to the port number. Okay, so 27,000, that's 28.
Oh, that's the database.
The database is running. So if I do a little listing of processes, oh, yes, thank you. I always want. I think I'm Mondo 3000 or something. So you see here, we've got this MongoDB running as process 4939, and it's looking using a config file /etc/mongodb.conf. So no. I just want to see if I could. Yeah, I noticed the user also it's running as. It's not running as me. It's running as MongoDB. So here's a configuration file. What's it do? It says the database path is where to store data? Var lib MongoDB. Where to log? Var lib MongoDB, MongoDB.log. Log append true. Bind to IP 127.0.0.1. So it only listens to localhost. Localhost is always a synonym for 127.0.0.1, which is your own IP address always. All right, yes?
Could you
bind two to, like, your lower corpus and, like, two externally?
Yes, you could. Yes, you could. You could bind to anything. But notice this line right here. Turn on off security. Off is currently the default. So what this means is anyone who talks to the MondoDB server can do anything they want to the databases.
That's brilliant.
But
Sounds faster.
Yeah. No, but this isn't completely dumb because it only is binding to localhost. So it's saying programs running on this box can talk to the database. No, nothing else can talk to it. So that's what that binds. If it bound to the Ethernet, you know, port, or just bound to all, you know, network addresses, then it would listen to the entire world, and that would be very bad. Now you're just subject if any program on your system goes nuts and starts talking to the database. It's fine, but you know, how would you talk to the database locally? You'd probably have some sort of username and password stored in a file. So if I'm locally on the box, I can get the username and password and I can get to the database. So it where you want the authorization is if you have the database and the web server on different machines. And then you have to do some configuration. But by default, it works out of the box and it is actually reasonably secure as long as you trust the programs on your box. So you quit. Was there a question here? So, so there's a few options. I can explain what journaling and other things are, but what it is, this is a program. When we installed the MongoDB package on Ubuntu, that was one of the packages installed, it automatically installed, configured, and started running the database. That's one of the things I love about Ubuntu, by the way. This comes from Debian. But when you install a new server or something, it comes configured in a sane state. You just install it and run it, and it's there to use. So that means that, there's probably something now in varlib MongoDB. So let's go. Sure enough,
they're in the no group thing, but they're all MongoDB files owned. And there's a node Mongo blog. It's created a couple of files for it. These files aren't that small. You know, they're 64 megs, 128 megs, 16 megs. So, this is part of the nature of databases. Almost always, when you start an empty database, it is not started off as zero length files. It normally pre-allocates a significant amount, naturally not huge. And by today's standards, you know, 100 megs, whatever. And actually, when we say 100 megs, I don't know if these actually, I'm not sure if these are zero length files, these are sparse files or not. Yeah, so they actually are taking up that much space. Okay.
Did you purposefully timestamp it to meet?
What?
Did you purposefully timestamp it to meet?
To meet? No. No, I didn't. That's just right now. That's pretty funny.
That is cute.
Guess that's just the class word, huh? So, but you all see that when you're running, so when we talk to the database server, or I say use a database, there is a separate program running for storing the articles. And it is persistent. Meaning, if I kill this now, killed it. Now I'm restarting it. Now I go back here and I reload. Still there. The post is still existence. Still elite. So what's this page? So the idea is that it actually creates, it listens for requests. The MongoDB server listens for requests on port 27017 by default. You could change that, but they've just configured it to be this. I think by convention it's the port it likes to use. And then it says you go up 1,000 and then you get to a web server that it runs. This is finding out what it's doing. And you can say, oh, look.
I like how Mongo Demon looks like Mongod.
Mongod. So we have here, there's a lot of statistics saying the write locks. It's got a little log here. You can find out what it's been doing. You can see connection accepted from here. Okay, new data file. Let me see if I can make this a little bigger. So it does. So this is nice. You can actually see, is my program actually talking to the database? Wow, look. Allocating new data file, varlib mongodb node mongo blog.ns. Where'd that name come from? It was. If you look here. His article provider says this DB, new DB, mongo-node-mongo-blog, new on server host port, which is what we passed it here when we create a new article provider in here. This function calls this, and this creates a new DB, and DB comes from require mongodb.db. We use the MongoDB module, assigned as DB method. We could assign the required MongoDB and just had MongoDB at the top. But instead, by doing this, it's just a little more convenient. Yes?
Does required come from the cookie? Where does that require?
What's the require thing?
Yeah. Like where?
That's node modules. Okay. These are node modules. Remember. So this is just like loading, the routes or the other things. So, and you'll notice at the bottom, you'll see a call to exports. The exports object gets article provider. That's how it's visible outside the module. If you see anything that is required by something else, you should see a reference to exports. If you don't, there's nothing exported, and you can't access anything it did. So it seems a little silly. So, so this article provider is using MongoDB to store the articles. Before we had the dummy one, this is the one using the database. So let's compare. So this one, let's look first at the find all. So find all. It gives a function that takes a callback, and you just call the callback with this dummy data. There's nothing to do in the dummy one because it's just stored in an array, and it's just returning the array. But you go over here. Where is it? Add comment to article, get collection, find all. This is the find all here, for this one. So it says function callback, and it says this get collection. So it's assuming that this is some sort of database. And then, that's what it's a method of. And it's saying get collection, and then it gives it a callback. And this callback says, article collection find. You're getting the collection. The collection is the actual database. And the article collection is going to be bound to it. And then if you had problems getting it, you couldn't get the proper collection, then you call the callback here. You say callback the error. Otherwise, you call article collection.find.toArray. So MondoDB, when you call find, it returns everything. Well, you can give it a query parameter, but if you don't give it a query parameter, it just gives you everything it can find. And then we're saying when you give back all the things you find, turn it into an array. I want an array of all the articles. And then the results of it, but you notice, see this function right here? Calling the database and telling it to return all of its contents might take a while. You don't want your web server to wait for this operation to complete before doing something with it. So what you do is you do this call and you say, don't give the results to me. Give the results to this other function, which I am defining right now. That's what this anonymous function here is. It's saying, here are the results, call it with the results in the error. And it says, did I actually get an error or not? If I got an error in getting all the results, then do the callback, which we called up here, to tell it the error. Otherwise, call the callback, which was given originally up here, with the results and a null error, because there wasn't an error.
So won't this will wait until find returns?
No, it will not wait at all.
But find needs to find everything and then return control back to this function so that it can
what happens is this function terminates. See, what happens first pass through this function is it just calls this get collection and defines this function.
Yeah.
Then this returns.
Yeah.
It defines this function, calls this get collection. But this get collection now is going, basically just says, okay, I'm going to start off my operation and I'll call this later. Basically, it's doing some stuff in the background. It's now, this is what is known as being asynchronous. Is that it's going to call this other function at some point in the future.
But, okay, now we're calling that function.
No, we're not.
Now it's the future.
Okay, now it's the future. Okay, now it's
so
being
now
called.
We're calling it.
Okay. Because we figured out what the collection is.
Yeah, so article collection.find has to run and return control back to now in order to call.
Nope, because its argument is another function.
But that's the argument of toArray. How does find know that toArray is going to be called on whatever it returns?
Oh, I see what you're saying. So you're saying article collection.find.
Yeah.
So as I understand it, this find will return an object, which you then That's true. This find could in principle block, but it doesn't.
Okay.
So what that means is that this, as I understand, what makes sense from this API is saying you're running this find. The results are not necessarily there yet. This puts in the request, and then you have to do another command to pull out the results, and that's what the toArray is. But you're right, exactly. This call to find could block, but it doesn't.
Okay.
Instead says this, and then this toArray then is called, and it then says, okay, when I have the result, I'll call this callback function and give it the results. It might be in 10 hours, but I'll call it then.
The future is the future.
So if you're trying to explicitly trace through the flow of control when you're having lots of callbacks, it gets very annoying, very fast, and very confusing. Don't do it.
Well, it's more a question of what do we not do so that stuff doesn't block?
In general, the APIs are designed so they don't block. The only time you have to worry about blocking is if you're going to do some computation, which is going to take a while. If you're calling other things, that will take a while. If you're doing it in Node, they're designed to do callbacks. They won't block.
So
it's only if your code does. So if you sit there and start sorting a million line array or something, you're going to probably make your web server hiccup.
I guess the question is, how do you write something like that so you don't block?
Well, remember, Node is single-threaded. So the only way to really do these things so they don't block
another process?
Is set it off to another process.
Okay.
or you split it up into lots of little pieces, which gets very annoying. So you better just learn the process. So this is all database stuff. So what you're really doing is you're sending commands to the database. That's another process. And then you're getting results from the database.
So is the whole paradigm based on the notion that the web application doesn't actually, it's pretty dumb. Like the, and anything smart is typically done by some other technology that you hook into. But that node is...
Node is designed to be a dispatcher. As much as anything else. It's supposed to send data to from other things. Lots of computation can happen on the client, lots of computation can happen in the database. Node is just being this lightweight thing going, here you go, here you go, here you go, here you go. Now, modern machines, when we say lightweight, you can actually do a reasonable about a little bit of computation in those things, but for really heavyweight things, they're done by someone else. And really, for a web server, what are you going to do with a request? On the server side, you get a request, you're going to store it, you may even manipulate a little bit, and the computation you need for manipulating is probably pretty small. And if you need to do something really big, you set up another process to be some sort of server for it.
Is that easy to do? Can you clone a node process?
Well, that's the whole design of this. The real design, think about this, with the design of this, what happens if I run 5 instances of node talking to the same database? On 5 different machines, and have all of them talking to the same database. It'll work fine. Their point of synchronization is the database. The database has all the state. You can replicate node all you want, the front end. So you see, just by following this basic architecture, you get certain benefits, which helps you in a web context. So the other key things here, which I'll go through, and then I'll stop going through the code in detail, is this article. So find all just does this callback, gets all the results. This get collection. So you see, this get collection is what it's calling is right here, is up here. It says this DB collection, and again, it's giving a callback. Callbacks all the way down. And this is because you don't know when the database is going to respond. So you don't block. Find by ID, this is saying you want to look up a specific article. I want to show one post versus all the posts. You're doing the same basic thing, but article collection, find one. You get the collection, then you find one, and then you give the ID of the article collection DBs, bson serialize object ID create from hex string ID.
Oh, that's really human readable.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, if you parse it apart, you can kind of see what it's doing. It's taking, you give it the ID, and then it's like, and so this is the ID is the hex string, which is part of the URL, and then it says from the hex string create the object ID. Because it has its own internal format for object IDs. You can't necessarily get that from the string representation. It comes from the string representation to the object ID representation. And then then you serialize it, because it uses binary JSON formats, what MongoDB is based on. So this is saying, when you get that, give me the result. So there's a whole API for MongoDB. We will go through the API more in later lectures, and we'll talk about how you do things with databases. But I'm just showing that this, it's all the kind of operations you'd want to do. You want to find a particular thing that's stored in it. You want to find one by some criteria. You want to get everything there. Those are the sort of things you do with databases. So based upon that, why are database files, why don't they start off really small? Why pre-allocate storage?
It's expensive.
Yeah, well,
speed.
For speed. So it's expensive at start, you know, when you first build the database, it's expensive, so how does it speed it up later?
Well,
don't have to allocate space for a certain amount of time, so the operations will be faster.
So you don't have to do allocation every time you get a request, so that makes it faster. That's true. Also, it makes them contiguous. It means that you now get this big chunk of space on disk, and now you can put stuff in it. Now, it's not as big of a factor with solid-state disk versus hard disk and stuff, but you now have this contiguous area. You can put your articles in there, and you can just keep going through that quickly, and then you're going to get more space.
Probably array-based, since it's random access.
So array-based. Okay, so now you're making assumptions about the structure of data on disk in a database.
Probably shouldn't be, but...
Don't.
No?
You don't. So for any database, you don't know how it stores data. You never do. It tells you... You can specify the kind of things that go in the database, and we'll talk about the different kinds of things you can put into a database, but how it's stored in the back end is a mystery. It could be doing all kinds of crazy things. It could be doing deduplication between things. It could be transforming them. It could be on the fly compressing them. It could be reorganizing them, refactoring them. I mean, you don't know. So don't assume. What you do know with a database is the performance you see. So this is why when you build any application back with a database and you expect certain performance characteristics, you test it. You test it under load. You try to simulate what you expect it to be and see how it performs. Anyone who says, oh, it'll be fine, it won't have any issues, you don't know that. You may think, oh, I'm just doing this innocent operation. I'm doing this innocent operation. Basically, think of this as an opaque implementation of a very complex, persistent data structure, which is what a database is. You don't know how it works, so you can't effectively get an intuition of what will be fast and what will be slow. They will tell you what's supposed to be fast and what's supposed to be slow, but they never tell you the whole story. Because the whole story is in the code. So you're going to run your stuff, and do I know exactly how MongoDB stores stuff on this? Nope. Definitely not.
Look.
I can look. Let's look at the file. That's a good point. What does that file look like? Can I see? No, I can't. Well, I can read it if I become root. So the caret at sign means zero. That's the null ASCII representation. Let's see if I go to the end. Oh, look, I go to the end of it. Oh, no, I pass. Oh, there was something in there. Oh, look, here we go. I think it's getting... Okay, let's... Oh, sorry. So there it is. There's some text in there. There's first comments in there. Yeah. That's typical of a database file, is that it'll be mostly empty with things in very precise locations. Don't edit a database by hand. You're messing with a complex on-disk data structure. You're going to corrupt it. Don't do it. So you might step, wait a second. These databases are all complicated. Why am I going to even mess with one? I can implement it myself. How would you implement this by yourself? Let's think for this blog. What operation would you need to support? So if you just needed to store all the articles, you can just store them maybe one article per file. And then we can name all the articles by their ID number. right? We just have an ID number, that's the file name. We stick them in a directory, each article's a file. Okay, so if you want to retrieve one article, it's very easy. If I want to retrieve all the articles, it's very easy. But what if I want to do anything else? What if I want to find all the articles that have a certain title? Or what if I want to have tags and pull up all the articles with a certain tag? Yeah, I mean, I have grep. I can build my own index to find things. I can do my own linear time search through the files. I mean, I can do all kinds of things. And, you know, if your application's really simple, you can do it. But most of the time in a web application, when you start storing things persistently in the back end, you want to do this carefully. And I haven't even mentioned the nastiest part. How do you deal with concurrent access? How do you make sure your collection of articles, so one, let's say one thing wants to change the article, another one wants to read it, what version do you get? They say, well, I'm just running on one system. I've just got one instance of my web server, so it'll all be fine. True. What if you want to replicate? What if you want to scale up? Now you've got problems. That's what really a database comes in handy, is because now everything, all the synchronizations happens there. Things like MondoDB says, I want to make sure that when I do these set of operations, they all either happen or not all of them either happen. That's why we bother with databases. That's what we're going to talk about more, this whole notion of transactions, atomic operations, concurrency. This is what the real heart of databases is. Yes?
So I have a hard time believing that Netflix has one database.
They don't have one database. They have many.
No, but that's the thing. How would you have many requests, talking to many databases, but keeping data consistent throughout all copies of the database?
We're talking the results of many research papers. that there are many a PhD that has done to solve that problem. but that's what it really comes down to, is there's lots of details to get this sort of stuff right. By using a good database implementation, you get them for free. And you choose which database you want depending upon what kinds of things you want to store. Now, the last thing I want to talk about, I'm going to turn this off here. Enough playing with.
Okay.
Is the design of a database. It's saying, how are things put together? Really? So the first thing, the simplest thing when you're talking about a database schema, is if you're talking about a classic relational database, we're talking about a table. So this is a table. So there's standard database terminology. Relations and things and stuff, but I'm just going to use the one regular people use, which is fields and records and stuff. Yes? It is not a relational database. So I'm going to explain what that means after explaining this. So a schema, you have a table, and then we have certain fields, and then we have records. So this really kind of looks like a spreadsheet, if you think about it, except that it's a table, kind of cells, except that each of these has a type associated with it. for example, if I had a name here, normally you'd have the first one be like ID, you have a name, address. These would have types associated with them. Like this would be a string, this would be a number, maybe a long int. You have types associated with all these, and then you have records associated with it. The relational part of relational databases comes from connecting multiple tables together. So a relation is saying, how is this table related to this other table? So for example, if I have another table, let's say here for this ID, here, and then I have an invoice. So here I have invoice number, description, amount, and then a customer ID. So this customer ID is, so this particular column would be related to the ID here. It means every entry that's in here should have a record over here. Can we have duplicates of this field in this table? Yes, because the same customer may have made many purchases. But should we have duplicates here? No. The customer ID should all be unique. Anything that should always be unique in a record is known as a primary key. The primary key is the thing that keeps these unique. You can also define secondary keys, and that's really the purpose of indices, is to define basically other ways of sorting the records. Because let's say I want to sort by name. Now, names may not be unique, so they're not a good primary key, because I want to be able to refer to each of these records uniquely. That's why I need this identifier. But I want to be able to give an alphabetical list of all their customers. So how do I do that? Now, this might be really big. I can't even load this into memory and sort it. So how do you do it? You just make an index, and an index is just a mini table, which would just be name and ID. This is a sorted list of names, and for each name, it's what the ID is. So if you want to give the full customer's name, a list of customers in sorted order, you use this index. You print out the things in the index, and then to print the whole record, you use these IDs to go over here and find them, and then get the other fields. So all you have to sort is the index, which at most has, is based on just a few fields. Yes?
So the index on the other table in the database.
So an index is associated with the table.
Oh, so it's like the primary key and then maybe like another secondary key in the index.
No, this is how you define a secondary key.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I want to be able to access things in the table in an order different from how it's defined. I want to be, because it's all about finding things. How are you going to find something in a database? Are you going to do a linear search through it? That would be bad. So the only way you're going to be able to find something is you have to know what order it's in, because then you can do an effective search. You can do a binary search. You can do hashes. You can do lots of ways of finding things. But it's all dependent upon it being in a sane order. That's what indices are, is for defining multiple orders of the same data instead of having all the data in one, instead of like, oh, let's just rearrange this, all this data every time I want to have a different order. That's painful. So instead, you build these indices, and it may be an expensive operation to build the index. But once you have the index, now you have a different order. And so you can now this is how you do fast searches. If I want to do a search on a name, and this thing's only, if I don't have any indices other than I just have the main table, then I'm going to do a linear search.
I have to check every record to look for the name. If I have the index that's sorted by name, then I just look through it. Alphabetically, I do, you know, jump to K if I'm looking for a name start with K, and then I can find it that way. So, but these, of course, take extra space. So you have to make the decision of for queries that you're going to do frequently, you build the index. For queries that you're not going to do frequently, you don't build the index and you pay the cost of doing the linear time search when you do the query. Yes?
So MongoDB, does it decide what kind of search you're going to be doing every time you make a query?
So you have to build indices if you for optimizing the kind of queries you want to do. This is part of the thing of database administration, is doing what indices you want to build. By picking the right primary key, the primary key is always, I'll explain MongoDB in a minute, but this is the basic relational idea. Relational databases, this is a classic thing. This is the thing Oracle made their money off of. Oracle databases are really nice in the sense of you can build really, really big tables and have lots of these tables and relate them all together, and then the database itself can do lots of computation on these tables and the relations in the database by giving it appropriate queries in their own programming language. That's what an Oracle application is. It's an application that runs on the database engine that can do various kinds of data manipulation. Now, there's one basic limitation of the relational database strategy, which is this. What happens if you want a new field? If you want a new category?
Everyone gets it.
And then what happens if you have a field that only maybe a couple of these records need? Everyone has to pay the storage for it. It's a very rigid kind of arrangement. Everyone has to have all the same fields. MongoDB is not a relational database. It's more of a document store. In particular, it is schema-free. Meaning, there is no, instead of records, it has documents. And documents are, to a first approximation, like a JSON object. You just have a property and a value. And any document can have any set of properties. There's no fixed thing that, okay, one document in the collection has to have certain properties and other ones do not have it, that's perfectly fine. If you want every document to have a certain set of properties, that's up to you as a developer. The database does not enforce that. So you can see under some circumstances that can be very nice, other kinds of circumstances, it's not. Depends on whether you need that flexibility. Now, databases, relational databases, can give certain kinds of guarantees under certain kinds of concurrent operations, which it's harder to do with these document type stores. But it turns out in web applications, you normally don't need those other guarantees. So this is part of what we're talking about with database design, is what are the guarantees, under what circumstances do I use different things. But basically, for all of what you're doing, what you can do with MongoDB is store JavaScript objects persistently. It's a little less flexible than standard JavaScript in the sense of you should have types associated with these. And I think the type, I'm trying to remember if the type has to be the same for a property of the same name. I think it does. No, it's JavaScript. No, so MongoDB is not JavaScript. It has a JavaScript interface. It actually has a JavaScript console built into it, but it is not JavaScript itself. It is written in C, I think. So C or C++. So it has its own thing in the back end. So there's actually some hacks to make it visible from JavaScript. But the thing I want you to take home is that this databases are this way we've come up with of storing lots of data in ways that you can find it and query it. There's a whole theory behind it, which we're going to start talking about it, but for right now, for your design, your application, you need something to store stuff. MongoDB is probably going to be more than enough for what you need. It's relatively easy to use. It has a very nice JavaScript interface. And so we'll start trying to, you know, show you that. Okay, so there are some questions.
That's not a requirement.
What, huh? It's not a requirement. Node has very good support for MongoDB, but if you want to use another one, Node has support for those others. But you've got to use, I mean, if you really want to use SQLite or something like that, potentially, I'm not so excited about SQLite, but well, it depends on what you're doing, but these are all pretty easy. Yes, so, oh, sorry, question? Yep.
For the purposes of the project, we are to install the Node Mongo module into our app, but assume that the TAs will have an instance of Mongo available, or how is that going to be?
Hmm?
Like, there's MongoDB, the C, like the actual application. Do we check that into Git as well?
If you notice, I didn't define any code in Mongo. Node's doing everything from itself. It's just talking to the database.
Well, that's what I mean.
So,
you
have to install.
Yeah, are we assuming that the TAs will be marking it? Will have.
The TAs are not going to be running your code. They can potentially. They're going to be more looking at your code, talking with you, and you should be demonstrating your code.
Okay.
So. Us, the TAs having to spend time getting your thing running and getting it all set up and stuff is a bit painful. They might want to look at it sometime to see if there's anything actually functional, but mostly they're going to be looking at the code, looking at the reports, and having you show them how your stuff works. Remember, there's a demo milestone. So. Okay, and so I'm doing the questions a bit differently. I will show you what we have here for questions, but there's going to be more questions. So I'll say MongoDB is a relational database. Hmm? False. In the blog example, article-provider.save can add one or many articles to the database. True. Remember, it can. Yeah, and. I should change that to be, yeah, well, when we talk about the database, then we're talking about the MongoDB version. ArticleProvider.save refers to the Oracle database using what identifier? So, anyway, you can look at these things. I'm going to add a couple of more questions. One thing I've noticed is it seems like you all are not actually doing the tutorials on your own. I'm not going to switch now to required tutorials because that would be too painful. But what I will do is change the lecture questions to be harder. So I will give you more time for them, but you're going to have to look at the code in more detail and figure stuff out, because it seems some of you need a little more motivation to work through these things. I was hoping that building your own app and stuff, you would be kind of doing this stuff, but that doesn't seem to be the case. So I will give you more code examples. So there will be some code examples, and you'll have through the weekend, basically until next lecture, to do this. Okay? See you next week. And there will be a tutorial up for tomorrow and Monday.